Battlefields, Reel 2. John Parry continued for about 10-11 minutes, then into John Howard.
If there was a failure of communications there, we would light yellow smoke canisters, which we all carried, and these, after a certain hour, would, we hope, be seen by aircraft of the Fleet Air Arm, and these would be a success signal, and the Fleet Air Arm aircraft would communicate with the air diffuser not to fire. Well, now, for many years, as I've been doing this for the last, I started this in 1955 on the battlefield tours, and we have never really discovered what really happened with regard to this success signal, or lack of it. The point is that air diffuser did not fire, and I do not know, and I don't think anybody else does, why she did not fire. We had no direct communication. It is conceivable that some aircraft saw these yellow flares or these yellow smoke canisters and said, "Don't fire," since the guns would have been already have been dealt with. Be that as it may, she didn't fire, but we were not to know that, and it was therefore necessary to get the troops out as quickly as possible. It was very near time to fire. And again, this assistant adjutant whom I met reminded me of the time and said we really must get cracking, get the troops out and away. Well, we rallied as many as we could around us and directed them to go through in that direction towards the guardhouse, which was the only entrance or exit of this position. This we knew from previous intelligence. And I was now faced with my own personal withdrawal. I had lost a certain amount of blood, I was rather weak, and hobbling still. And I hobbled off to this wretched guardhouse, seeing very few others left behind. And just as I got there, I saw on the ground, or near this little guardhouse, a sort of trolley. It consisted of two perambulator wheels, two or three slats of wood, and a shaft. And I thought,
well, this is absolutely marvellous. I will withdraw on this. So I lay on my back on this machine and began to propel myself with my right heel and found the job somewhat exhausting. The track was cratered, it was a rough sort of track anyway, and I would have some distance to go to the rally point, which, as you have been told, was a cavalry about, the best part of a kilometre from here. I wasn't making very good progress, and I had more or less resigned myself to being put in the bag. However, fortune was with me, and I saw, not so very far away, an NCO, whom I knew, and I hailed him. He came back to me, looked at me somewhat quizzically, and I told him that I was withdrawing, so yes, and I said, "Now, will you please help me?" He tied his toggle rope to this vehicle and pulled me along. We went along and finally arrived at this cavalry. On the way, I sustained myself by having several mouthfuls of whiskey, which I carried with me, and my morale was nearly quite high. Now, the next job after this was to go to La Plaine, which raises the question of casualties. Some 80 had been knocked down, killed or wounded in the battery or immediately outside it. So the battalion, as it was became apparent, checking at the rally point, was down to about 70, all ranks, and with very few officers. I myself I'd lost quite a lot of blood, and I couldn't really go any further, and I was taken into a chateau, which had been designated as a temporary aid post, if you like, for wounded. And there were, when I went in there, there were some 30 or so of our own battalion, and I joined them. We had acquired the services of a German medical orderly, an elderly gentleman who had a satchel attached to him containing presumably first aid equipment and a water bottle. He had a Geneva Cross brassard on his arm. So we invited this gentleman to stand at the door of this chateau and to tell any of his friends who might come along during the day not to enter as it contained wounded troops. And in the hours that we were there, we saw no Germans at all. Everything was now very quiet. The battalion went on to its next objective, and there were we in the chateau. We remained there all day until, surprisingly, at about 6, I think, that evening, maybe a bit earlier, the padre turned up. Now, he'd been dropped some way away from the DZ, not too far away. He'd gone, made his way to a place called Le Menil, which was where brigade headquarters was to be established, got hold of an old vehicle, which happened to be an ex-British Army 800-weight truck, which had been in the hands of Germans in Dunkirk, presumably. He had a driver, and he made his way across country to the chateau, where he began to evacuate the 30 or so wounded troops. I went up with about the third or fourth party, I suppose. In the meantime, a Red Cross had been fashioned locally, some nearby chateau, and this German to whom I've already referred was invited to sit upon the nose of this truck and to display this Red Cross on his chest, so that we hoped the vehicle would not be fired upon during its many journeys from this chateau back to Le Menil. The game was very rough. The cross country, there's an enormous amount of bomb craters, the roads were cratered, and we saw quite a lot of Germans on the way, but they made no attempt to engage. When I arrived at this place, Le Menil, a lot of wounded lying there, and I met the brigadier for the first time, and he was hobbling rather badly. He had, in point of fact, been hit in the rear by a piece of Allied bombing. But General Crookenden will deal with that later. It's another story. The field ambulance, those that survived the drop, were operating. Their surgical teams were operating. And the adjutant, to whom I've referred, he was immediately operated upon. And I suppose that immediate operation saved his life. Because there were no medical facilities at that time, obviously, all wounded had to be evacuated. I finished up in a hospital near Swansea, and by which time it was about D+5, I was very well, and I thought, well, I can't stay here, especially as I heard the sad tidings that all officers of the Airborne Division would, on being formally discharged from hospital, be sent to the Airborne Forces Depot at a place called Chesterfield. I had been there once before, and I made up my mind I would never go there again. If I did, I would finish the war there, and possibly my life. So I decided, as I was quite fit, to discharge myself from hospital. I made my way to Bulford, which was our base in the United Kingdom, then to Headquarters Airborne Corps, where I obtained from the DA and QMG a piece of paper authorizing me to return to France. And within a few hours, I was back with the battalion. We were then in what was called the rest area, the divisional rest area, on the banks of the Orne. It was fairly peaceful, except we used to get the overs, the enemy overs, so we had to be dug in. A day or two later, the battalion moved up to Le Menil with brigade headquarters. I was happily in my little hole in the ground a day or so after that, when a very irate divisional commander appeared. I didn't see him at first. He sent for the CO, and he said, "Have you an officer by the name of Parry in your battalion?" CO said, "Yes." Said, "Well, the general said he's absent." And the CO said, nonsense, well, where's that effect? He'd seen me within the last hour or two, and he was quite certain that if I had gone absent in the last hour or two, he, the CO, would know before the general. And the CO couldn't understand why I was thought to be absent. This is a reference to my not being in hospital where I should have been. And I was summoned to the presence. The general said, "Are you Parry?" And I said, "Yes, I was." And he said, "Well, you're absent." I said, "No, I'm not absent, I'm here." So what's the meaning of this? I said, I couldn't understand it. He said, well, he'd received a report from London to the effect that I, Parry, of the 9th Battalion, was adrift. And I said, well, the War Office, or it was, must have made a clerical error. The General said, the War Office does not make clerical errors. So I said, oh. Then eventually I came clean, more or less. I apologized for any misdemeanor I might have thought to have committed, and went back to my hole in the ground there to continue the war. Now, I must tell you something about what happened to these gliders and to account for the wide dispersal on the landing. First of all, the gliders. I've told you about the one that crash-landed in the orchard, and I've told you that one landed at Odium and another one landed somewhere in the area of the River Dease. Although the battalion on leaving here was 70 or 80 strong, within two or three days it had gone up to about 200. First of all, the party that landed at Odium was able to make its way to RAF Brize Norton, where the air landing brigade was to take off that evening, and they managed to get over with that brigade. So that produced another 30 soldiers. Gordon Brown's glider, the one that landed near the Dives, he was OC, the coup de main force. He was all complete, and that was another 30 soldiers. Ian Dyer, OC C Company, came in on about D plus 3 with about 40, having skirmished on the way. And so it went on, literally for days, weeks, and even months later, soldiers were trickling back. And it became evident that the battalion had, in point of fact, not only the battalion, but other units of the division, had dropped over in an area of some 50 square miles, which was quite a big DZ.
This is a recording of John Howard at Pegasus Bridge, recorded on a battlefield tour in 1973. John Howard commanded the coup de main glider party that landed on Pegasus Bridge before midnight on D-1, the 5th of June, 1944.
Now, gentlemen, the first... There are very, very many reasons of why this operation was successful. As you know, I have the... Oh, God, he told me about that, though. I knew the... everybody knows that I've got the pleasure of telling you a success story. The three mate, and then halfway over the channel, there was some wag at the back, said... As a major ladies' kit yet? Well, as I told you, I was always sick, but I wasn't on that night. The only time that I had a glider flight that I wasn't, obviously because I had other things to worry about. But apart from that, it was forced humour atmosphere, as you can imagine, on an occasion like this, and we came over Cobourg round about midnight or just after. We cast off at 6,000 feet, as I explained just now, came down to 1,000 feet, and as we'd practiced over in UK, Den Brubbage, we undid his belt. You sit facing one another in the gliders, and each glider has a door at the front, which pushes up like that, and one at the back. And the drill was to open these doors as soon as we flattened out. Den undid his safety belt, leaned forward, and I hung on to his equipment and his sergeant on the other side, and he opened this door. And as he opened the door, I could see, I was sitting right opposite the door, I could see these quiet Normandy fields that I'd studied so many times in the aerial photographs, I could almost recognize exactly where we were from the times I'd studied the fields. But magnificent, wonderful livestock you have in this part of the world were there grazing very, very quietly, so used to planes passing over, and there was a lot of traffic going on and bombing corn and the coast and what have you. And it was just like being on an exercise in UK. Everything was quiet, and the chaps were quiet by this time, of course, under orders. Well, the 7 minutes run in seemed to go in next to no time. Two or three times, the glider pilots, as we'd planned, put their thumbs up to show that they were dead on course. Everybody in the glider could see them, and we knew that we were at least going to land somewhere near the right area. We did the right-hand turn. We felt the lurch on that. We knew that the next right-hand turn was coming, and then we had that feeling of the run-in. Well, you run in on those gliders at anything up to 90 miles an hour. We knew we were going to lose the wheels, and we were going to land on skids, and all the bottom comes up. We knew all sorts of things could happen, because they're only made of plywood, these gliders, and even on airfields in England, that they used to get smashed up. The drill coming in, is to link hands. You're facing one another. First of all, you link arms, butcher's grip, and then hold up both your legs and just pray to God. And that was the sort of ridiculous position that we were all in as we came in at this tenth time. The things going through your mind under those circumstances, well, as far as I was concerned, I imagine that we were all thinking of one's families and things, but at the top of my mind, I can well remember, was the question of explosives. These poles, despite what Staff Sergeant Warwick had said, we all know that there's one there, but there's always one in the middle to stop you. And I knew from reports of Sicily that if one thing went off in the glider, the whole lot of ammunition, Bangalore torpedoes, mortar bombs, everything will go up as sympathetic detonation. And that was, I think, my biggest scare. Because, I mean, you couldn't come over here with your grenades unprimed. You couldn't just stand here. Just a minute, Jerry, I've got to prime a bloody grenade and all this sort of business. It just wasn't on. So we were there and we were very vulnerable to this explosion. Also, once you get there, of course, we know that one LMG trained on a glider could wipe out the whole outfit. Well, those were the sort of worries, and one major worry that had been on my mind all the way through this, since I was briefed in April, was would the plan be the right plan for the maximum safety of life of the troops? It might seem odd that one should come to you on these occasions, but it does. And I can remember on this fly-in, that was another one of the things that were flitting through your mind. Well, we touched down, must have been about 100 yards or so short of where we finished up. We were airborne again, you bump, airborne again, and then there was a rending crash, dust, splintering wood, and the whole lot seemed to stop so suddenly, and you had 100% noise to 100% silence. It seemed that we were almost dazed and semi-conscious or unconscious for quite a long time, but in actual fact it could only have been a few seconds. But we'd practiced this drill so many times in UK, as soon as we knew where we were, we immediately started getting through the gliders. So the first thing I remember was I couldn't see anything. I banged my head in landing, and I was a bit scared about this because I wondered if I'd bumped my head. But all that happened was I bumped up on the top of the glider, and my battle bowler had come down over my eyes, and I couldn't see anything. Anyway, I eased that up, and the first thing I saw was that the door of the glider had telescoped. Poor old Jim Warwick and his brother, the co-pilot, were in the nose of the glider, which had telescoped also, and they were terribly cut about. But our thing was to get out of that glider before any gun could fire at us. The lead-in section we'd planned was to come out of the back of the glider, deal with the pillbox. And while I struggled out, not through the door, but through the back, and came up this path, first thing I saw was the tower of the bridge less than 50 yards away from me. Well, you can just imagine the sight of that, plus the fact that there was no firing at all, the sense of exhilaration that I still feel when I see that longest day film, and feel that feeling when you have the fly-in. But there was no time to think about that at the time, except that feeling of exhilaration, because there was still no firing, and the first thing I saw was the smoke bomb. I knew the chaps were putting the 36 grenades through. They were on a short fuse, and I heard the thump thump within the pillbox. And the leading platoon, led by the subaltern Den Brubridge, crossed the bridge. As they got to the far side of the bridge, the firing started, and they were the first shot. They fired. Firing came from round the Gondre Cafe somewhere, and Den Brubridge was shot, leading his platoon across there. As this happened, I heard two more crashes, and I could hardly believe it, and to believe that the other two platoons had got there. And sure enough, almost within seconds, it seemed to me, David Wood, who's now full colonel commanding the records office at Exeter, came puffing up with his young soldier platoon, and I said, number two task, and off he went to clear these defences. At about the same time, I got the news that Den Brubridge had been very badly wounded and they thought he was dead. Then Sandy Smith on the 3rd Platoon came up. They'd had a very bad landing. He himself had broken his arm. He was a Cambridge Rugger Blue. His arm was in his battle dress. I made quite sure that he was all right.
I was a bit worried because I knew Dan Brothers was out, and I said, you've got to go across, Sandy. He said, well, that's okay. I coordinate those two platoons over there, and his platoon went. And there I was in the relatively happy position of three platoons here. At the same... Oh, the bridge is going up, so you've got to get your diversion. The next thing that happened after that was David Wood, in clearing these trenches, was shot with his platoon sergeant and runner the other side of the pillbox and was out of action. Den Brothers was out of action, so only had one platoon here, one platoon commander here. And I was beginning to feel a bit unhappy because I hadn't heard from the river bridge at all. But then things seemed to change, although the other thing was that the doctor was missing and nobody could find him. But things changed suddenly. First, Jock Nelson, commanding the sappers, came up and told me that there were no explosives over the bridge. So whatever Darrell Zanuck tells you, gentlemen, there were no explosives under that bridge that night or the other bridge. We found the explosive in a little shed, the end of the trenches, that's, later on that night. Then we picked up the other bridge. And what had happened there was this. Brian Friday, my second in command, with that platoon, landed by the River Deave and didn't come into this battle at all. And theirs is a fine story on its own, and I can't go into detail now. Number 5 platoon, commanded by Todd Sweeney, now deputy commander at Warminster, he landed half a mile short. Number 6, Dennis Fox, now out of service, he landed on the dot. So he was the first one up on that bridge. And when Tom Sweeney arrived about 10 minutes later, there was a lot of firing going on over here. They captured that without any firing. He found Dennis standing in the middle of the narrow bridge, looking round as quietly as ever. Everything all right, Dennis? Said, I think so, Tom, but I can't see any bloody umpires anywhere. And that was the start of the fun of that bridge. Well, then we soon broke that up. I left Todd over there on the bridge, and as planned, brought Dennis Fox's platoon here across to do the fighting patrol job that I've already told you about. So the picture now, gentlemen, is with two platoons the other side. They're commanded by one subaltern with a broken arm. One platoon here commanded by a corporal, and one platoon coming across to do fighting patrol, and another one sitting on the river bridge. By this time, it was, I suppose, about 20 past. We'd been down about 20 minutes. And it was there a question of sitting here waiting for the parachutists to arrive. Now, the paradrop was really a wonderful and inspiring sight. We heard all these hundreds of planes coming in that direction over the LZ where you were with Nigel Taylor just now. And we saw them jumping. We saw the searchlights going up to meet them. There was a bit of firing and tracer firing going up there. But it was a grand feeling here to know at least there was somebody else here with us. We didn't know what time they would come. They thought about an hour, but in the event it turned out to be a lot longer for reasons that you've already heard from Nigel. Round about then, we started sending out the Hammond James signal straight away. Round about this time, we found the doctor. He was covered in head to foot in mud. He stunk like a polecat. The poor bugger had been thrown into that pond. And he was a bit dazed, and I had a small bottle of scotch in one of my Sten gum pouches, which for such occasions, and I gave him a drop of this. He shook his head, and the first words were, "What's all this bloody ham and jam about, John?" Well, he, like all the troops, he knew the importance of it during all the briefing. But anyway, the Scots did what it was supposed to do. It cleared his head. And I said, right, well, get back to the FAP. Dan Brothers is back there, and I think he's dead. David Wood's there, and there were quite a few casualties back there. Okay, John, I'm off. And he straight away started wandering across the bridge. And that's where Darrell Zanuck got that part in his book, which is all bunkum, really, the way he put it. But that's where he got the idea from. Well, John Vaughan went back and did a wonderful job after that, because once he cleared his head, he was okay. Now, the paras we were waiting for, it was a gamble whether they would get to us before the counterattack. But the counterattack came first, or at least the signs of it. By this time, Dennis Fox was up on the, well, the other side of the perimeter, alongside the road leading up to the Mary at the top there, and we heard two tanks moving about on the top row junction. They turned and came down the road very, very slowly. The only thing we had to stop them, we couldn't fire that gun at night, was the pit. The pit is, if you don't know, gentlemen, is a weapon that has a very high trajectory. The bombs are about that length, and if they don't hit fair and square, they don't explode, and you've got to go all through the rigmarole of reloading and firing another one. Well, as you can only fire those when you see the whites of their eyes, they're, of course, on top of you before you can get the second bomb in. But as luck would have it, the first bomb was bang on. And the bomb, the half-track, as it was, must have been chock-a-block full of ammo, because that brewed up for a good hour or so afterwards. And the parachuters, as you heard from Nigel, thought we were having a hell of a battle over here. In actual fact, at that particular time, there were no shots being fired in anger at all. And but it went on with quite a spray. But I'm quite convinced that putting that half-track out of action at that time saved us the counterattack, because we had no more except recce patrols. The other tank turned around and ran away before we'd get a shot in at it, and we had no more attacks in this area at all. In fact, nothing really bad on these bridges for the next few days. The liaison officer, of course, had already gone off over the bridges to meet Geoffrey Pinecoffin to tell him what was happening here. Well, when the 7th Para arrived, which wasn't until after 3 o'clock, we had a few, the odd parachuters who'd landed on this side come in first, but Geoffrey Pinecoffin didn't come through until almost 3:30, and they went straight across the bridges and were in contact with the enemy straight away. His headquarters was just this side of the church on the skyline there, Benneville Church, and the fighting with the enemy, in contact with the enemy, went on right on until we actually left the bridges area at on the night of D-Day. Nigel Taylor, and you'll be going down to his stand, moved left into that area over there, and we knew that they were in contact with the enemy immediately on for the rest of the day. By this time, we had cleaned up the pillbox where we found Nazi flag, which is now in the Regimental Museum. It was a bit like a butcher's shop in there before we cleaned it up, but we managed to get in there, and it made a damn good company headquarters, of course. And at first light, I pulled in the...